Good evening, and welcome to Business Rewind, revisiting conversations with leading entrepreneurs in an exploration of business history. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5, the University of Manitoba. Our first interview this evening for Business Rewind is with Harry Rosen, originally aired on June 6, 2000 on UMFM 101.5. A quick business rewind. In 1954, Harry Rosen opened a small made-to-measure menswear store in Toronto with a $500 down payment and building his client base one customer at a time. Fast forward to 2019, that small company has grown for 65 years under three generations of entrepreneurial family leadership into one of Canada's best high-end men's clothing specialty retailers, renowned worldwide with 17 stores in 8 major Canadian markets, employing 1,000 associates. Here is the original interview from June 6th in 2000.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Entrepreneur Show, sponsored by the Astor Center for Entrepreneurship here at the University of Manitoba. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5. Let's go to today's first guest, Mr. Harry Rosen of Harry Rosen Menswear. Harry Rosen opened his first men's clothing retail store in the Cabbage Town area of Toronto 46 years ago. The cornerstone of the Harry Rosen philosophy is to inform, to bring to life his passionate expression of true elegance and style in men's clothing. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Show, Mr. Rosen. We appreciate you appearing on our show today.
Thank you, Susan. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. You have an intriguing story to share when speaking of how you began Harry Rosen Stores. Tell us about your entrepreneurial beginnings and what the true cornerstone of the Harry Rosen philosophy reveals about the man behind these beginnings.
Well, I was 22 years of age, and previous summers I had worked in a clothing factory and also in a retail shop. I went back to school that year a bit confused. And by Christmas exams, I realized that really I had this great passion to own a shop of my own. So I didn't return to school. In fact, I went out looking for a location. And thankfully, I had a mentor and a former employer of mine. He assisted me to some extent in finding a location. I was able to borrow $500 from a relative and start off by selling made-to-measure clothing in the east end of the city of Toronto, a very incongruous location for selling made-to-measure upscale clothing. I found that working through any customers I had and asking for referrals, impressing on them the quality of service and the quality of work we did, made them our best advertising. And as a result, I eventually wound up with a customer in the publishing business. And from that individual, through referrals, it grew to a point where I had a large following in the publishing business. The same thing happened with people in the advertising field. I used to write letters, call customers cold on the phone if I was given a referral. If somebody allowed me to use their name, I used their name. If I wasn't permitted to use their name, I all the same got my message across that there was something special going on here on Parliament Street, and it would be worth their while to come and visit us. If someone couldn't make it down that way, I was glad to come to their home and show them what we did, and hopefully at the hours that accommodated them and impress them with what we were doing.
So the passion and the quality of your designs puts you at the forefront of the Canadian menswear industry for this century?
I'd like to think those are two factors. Another very important factor, and something I learned later on to more or less organize in my mind, but up to then I was doing it in an instinctive sort of way, and that is really disseminating information on how men should dress. I understood a bit about men, how they like to boast that they don't like shopping, how shopping is a very uncomfortable activity for them. And I know all of that is not true, that once they find someone they can put their faith in, they become one-stop shoppers. I always felt that it was very important to know how to communicate the values in our products and the benefits that they brought to the consumer. Most retailers can't articulate that. I was able to do that, and as I honed my skills in doing that, I developed more and more loyalty in my customers and more referrals. My best advertising was a satisfied customer.
With the workplace changing and becoming much more casual, how have you changed your selection for those customers to accommodate the working man and still provide designs reflecting good taste and quality?
Well, most of the vendors that we have read the signs, as we have, of a good many businesses going casual either for the summer or throughout the year, and have developed complete collections. They had well-developed brand positions, people like Armani, Armenigildo Zegna, Hugo Boss, and a number of others. And they've developed, out of clothing being their strength, tailored clothing, into casual wear and a whole variety of of things that are appropriate for business casual, and we've trailed along and given them input, which I hope has been useful to them. The result is that our sales have grown by virtue of the kind of volume we're generating out of casual wear. But interestingly enough, our tailored clothing business, the business you'd think would be most affected, is really still quite strong. At least we're holding our own in that area. And I think that's because there are a lot of people dropping out, and so we're picking up more share of market, but the market's not increasing.
As far as making a good sales associate at Harry Rosen, what makes that kind of a sales associate at your stores?
I hire for enthusiasm and people that show a desire to please others, that get their pleasure out of pleasing others, that feel that doing that is a professional activity. With that, I'll develop their skills. I really don't look for people with experience because I find that the majority of them bring with them, I think, a lot of stuff that is pretty hard to shake out and alter their approach. We call it Rosenizing them. We've devoted a great deal of time training and writing training material, and that is information that is gleaned firsthand from my dealing with customers myself. I find that when I'm amongst large retailers in the United States at conventions and things of that nature, that they want to talk marketing, they want to talk all about promoting their business from a central point, you know, office type of arrangement, but they really have very little regard for the awesome task of directing thousands of people out there to knowing and being knowledgeable about their products and the benefits those products bring to the consumer, something that's just not within their span of thought. And I think that in that regard, we have the strongest position in that we have the best trained people. And in going forward and expanding our business, we can compete with people who are great marketers, but miss that very vital element, the service component, the people who understand our customer and are able to pick them up where they're at and take them a step beyond when it's appropriate to do so.
So in addition to Rosenizing your sales associates and doing the marketing that you do, you often extend your philosophy of informing by presenting your Dress for Success seminars for corporations. Can you tell us what you enjoy about that particular offering and how it continues to expand your client base?
Well, I enjoy it a great deal because it offers me the opportunity to dialogue with, as a general rule, people who are in business or finance, and they direct very good questions towards me, which certainly means I come away with certain information. Started with the banks. The banks asked me to come in when they had trainees from various parts of the country coming together here in the city of Toronto and talk to them about clothes and about how to select clothes and how to know quality and how to pick clothes that suit their personality. And I was able to do that, and along with a slide presentation, it became very popular. At that time, it was principally on tailored clothing. And now that it's moved in the direction of casual, I get calls, panic calls at that, from some of the major law firms in the city or even the banks who want me to come up and do a seminar for their employees and show them how to dress. It's interesting that for a great many men, dressing business casual is a mystery. Once you take your tie off, it's as though everything goes, you see. And they have to be given lines of demarcation as to what's appropriate for cutting the lawn and barbecuing versus being at business and looking quite professional in casual attire.
Do you find that some of the internet companies or some of the young people coming up today are the ones who might be setting that trend, and so you have to tailor it to that?
There's no doubt that it started in that regard, but I think IBM were the major movers some years ago, and I think it's about 10 or 11 years ago that they were a very firm that was very rigid in its approach to the way its representatives should dress. You had to wear a white shirt and a tie, and going back many years before that, you had to wear a hat, whether it was winter or summer. They came along and I think accepted casual dress within their ranks, and I think that really is a major mover towards a lot of industry turning in that direction. The casual dress, in my view, is here to stay, business casual, that is. But I'm not sure that there aren't certain businesses that are better served in wearing suits. Certainly men have fewer decisions to make when it comes to a suit.
Going back to some of your production, and is your inventory domestically produced or is it selected at international trade shows?
Some of our inventory is made in Canada. We're very proud of our Canadian vendors. They have lived up to our quality standards. We feed back to them whatever useful and constructive criticism we may offer to improve their products. And I think as a result, the NAFTA agreements, the companies in Canada that we've done business with have been quite successful in going to the United States, and they are thankful for having a very particular client like ourselves who knows quite a bit about the quality and how the consumer receives it and how it performs and feeds that back to them in a useful manner. But at least 50% of our merchandise is from overseas, and a good part of that is certainly from Italy.
Yes, I noticed that some of your ties and your crewnecks in your magazine entitled Harry were from Italy. Do you find that that publication is really helpful in promoting your designs?
In a survey we did just very recently, we were told by most of customers that the magazine enhanced their image of Harry Rosen and that they found a useful input into how to select their clothes and how to recognize value. The idea that I thought we had that was constructive about this was a way of talking to our customers. I wasn't so interested in selling them as educating them to quality. Now, some of the articles we're doing for this coming fall are really getting to ideas that I feel very enthusiastic about writing, and I'm really enjoying them and I enjoy the input. And I find some of these articles are, believe it or not, accepted by the retail community around the world. Many of them have asked for rights to publish some of these articles and put them into their own newspaper advertising or in-house bulletins.
You have a son in the business who was recently in Winnipeg and did a customer appreciation function. How is he involved in the business?
Well, my son is about 44 years of age. I'm 69, and he graduated from law with an MBA as well, and surprised me after practicing law for a few years that he was excited by retailing. So I welcomed him into the business. He started off at the very bottom. He had worked summers during his high school years. He became a buyer and worked his way from there to where he's the president of the company today. Working side by side with him, I find that certainly he has his own independent thoughts. But between the two of us, we synthesize, I think, the best of our minds. And I have to also look to he and our young buyers and the younger people in our business for new attitudes. I'm getting on in age, and new ideas sometimes, well, shall we say, some of them look strange to me initially. When you're younger and more accepting of it and you have a pulse on where things are at, it's younger people, I think, that are creating the whole evolution in lifestyle, and you've got to study youth. And my age doesn't, shall we say, inhibit me, but it is a factor I have to consider. So my son brings a nice, new, fresh vision, I think, to the business.
You'll be opening 11 new stores across the states over the next 2 years, and do you feel the Canadian market will be different from the American market?
The American market consumes much the same product mix. In fact, if anything, the average of clothing and furnishings in Canada are slightly higher in quality than what the general American mix is. But there's plenty of quality merchandise sold in the major centers like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and so on. We don't see it being any different as far as demand for product is concerned. We are positioning ourselves between major American department stores. We have to position ourselves between the Neiman Marcuses and the Saks and the Nordstroms, and they have an excellent assortment of goods, bought in many cases from the same vendors as ours. I think that our big advantage is the way we present our merchandise and collections. I think the perception of our offering is clearer in the way that we do it. The main thing that separates us from American retailing is our service. We work very hard to educate our people to understanding our customer and where they might take them. As I say, with majority of American retailers, or large retailers for that matter, just a mind-boggling undertaking to train a staff of hundreds of people to handle customers the right way. We have a legacy of being successful at doing that.
So why did you choose the name Hugo Boss and not Harry Rosen for your U.S. venture?
We were about to open our second U.S. store in Detroit. We were going to take on the space that was vacated by Barney's, who had gone bankrupt, 18,000 square feet of space. And we knew that it would take several years to make that store profitable in a very competitive market. We were offered just at that time, when we were about to sign the, after our total negotiations, the rights to open Hugo Boss stores in the United States. And what surveys we did showed that Hugo Boss was a well-known brand name, whereas Harry Rosen is known in Canada and known in parts of the United States, but certainly not known all over the United States. So this afforded us the opportunity to develop an organization and infrastructure that could see us do diverse work in the United States. And once we have the talent on board, we can develop further Harry Rosen stores and roll them out quicker than we could have by going through the process of learning by opening one store at a time and waiting 2 or 3 years before we open the next store. This makes the development and the revenue that we can take out of the United States much shorter in the time frame.
Your business has been a major success. What do you enjoy most about your working life?
Oh, there are so many things in our business I delight in, but I would say that every Saturday and Sunday I'm in our stores working with customers, servicing them, listening to their comments about our merchandise, about the services we provide. And when I come back to a Monday morning meeting and we review what happened the previous week, I've always got new insights. And when I go home on Saturday night after a store closing, I just feel so excited about utilizing the new ideas that are there for me. And it's constant. And in particular, as I say, I'm watching young people, looking at their new attitudes, trying to remain young is what it is. So my greatest pleasure is interacting with customers, learning how they feel about clothing and the experience they have in shopping at Harry Rosen.
Well, you can tell you definitely enjoy being around the customers, and you take a lot from them that you can apply to your designs. And I'd like to thank you very much for appearing on our show. I wish you continued enjoyment and success with your business, and we look forward to having you on our show again.
Thank you, Susan. I like that very much, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. That was Mr. Harry Rosen from Harry Rosen Menswear.
For those of you who have just tuned in, you're listening to Business Rewind, revisiting conversations with business leaders from the early aughts on UMFM 101.5. Our next interview for Business Rewind is with Mike Kirkman, originally aired June 6th in 2000 on UMFM 101.5. A quick business rewind, Mike Kirkman was the founder of the Dragon Boat Race Events Company in 1993, Great White North Communications Incorporated. Fast forward 2019, Mike Kirkman has left Great White North Communications Incorporated in the hands of a global event production company. He's relocated to Tampa, Florida in 2011, where he founded Pan Am Dragon Boat, a premier national and international supplier of high-quality dragon boat equipment and production services for dragon boat racing events. Here is the original interview from June 6, 2000.
Our next guest, Mike Kirkman of Great White North Communications Incorporated, he and his partner Barb Goldberg, who is originally from Winnipeg, began Great White North Communications Incorporated back in 1993. The company provides full-service marketing and management support for sports and special events, particularly events highlighting the sport of dragon boat racing. GWNC Incorporated is also a manufacturer and distributor of quality dragon boats and their colorful accessories both for purchasing and leasing. Welcome to the Entrepreneur's Show, Mike, and thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Dragon boat racing sounds quite fascinating. For those of us who haven't had the experience of observing or participating in a dragon boat race, can you describe one for us?
Well, it sort of goes back to the history of the sport. It's about a 2,000-year-old sport, participants all over Asia, and the culture says that a fellow by the name of Q1 drowned himself in protest of some government or some different factions in China way back when, and this dragon boat festival in modern times is actually a reenactment of the village fishermen who went out to try and save him and were beating the water with the paddles and bonging drums and throwing rice in the water to sort of lure the fish away from his body and things like that. So the Dragon Boat Festival is a very colorful, it's got a lot of Asian components to it, and again, the highlight is of course these long, slender, traditional teak boats painted in all kinds of dragon scale colors with the enormous dragon heads and tails fitted to the front and back with drums and drummer in the front booming the drum. And these boats are actually racing certain distances, so it's very frantic, lots of splashing and paddles and really incredible athletic display on top of that.
Why do you feel that the dragon boat racing is becoming increasingly more popular?
I think it's got a lot to do with just the user-friendliness of the sport, how easy it is to just literally hop in a boat, and if you're even slightly coordinated enough just to keep in sync or get your timing down with the rest of the paddlers in the boat, there's 20 paddlers in the boat, and if your timing is on, then you're doing it. There really is a steep learning curve with respect to technique and the specific development of the muscle groups required for the sport. It's not a huge cardiovascular sport where you're going to be totally uncomfortably out of breath, so it's just a user-friendly, fun way to socialize and participate in what's perceived by the audience to be a very athletic type of an event.
So I guess because it's such an easy sport to pick up, that your company is able to combine the sport with their marketing needs, and how do they go about providing that for them?
Well, I think initially companies got involved with the sport because it was a great team-building exercise. Literally put the CEO in the boat with the mailroom staff, and everybody could have a great team-building experience. And then they started to realize that these events were attracting huge audiences and other corporate teams, possibly with key people from those companies who would have some time between races to network with. And I believe many, many relationships, business relationships, are formed during these events, and that's why it's very attractive to corporations to put their teams into place and train for these events and also to sponsor the events as well.
So what sort of preparation for your company is involved just prior to an event?
Well, Great White North Communications, you refer to us as GWN, which is our acronym, but we're an event marketing company, and our specialization is dragon boat racing. So we've been in business for about 6 years, but as individuals, myself and my partner are involved in the sport for about 8 to 10 years. And basically, we service clients in different cities or towns in Canada and the United States who are interested in using this sport festival event as a fundraiser. And we provide full service, meaning we provide all the equipment, the boats, the paddles, life jackets, heads, tails, drums. We provide the logistics for the delivery of all the equipment. We can also provide, at the client's option, full consulting, meaning we would do pre-event consulting, provide them with critical paths. A lot of these committees that are put together have no event experience at all, so we give them direction in the months leading up to the event, and then we can also provide technical support on the weekend of. And we would bring our whole team of people in, set the race course, provide officials, referees, starters, do the marshalling of the teams, put the scheduling together, advance the teams through the schedule, through the day, all those sorts of things.
Well, I noticed also on the website and also from Barb that you do a lot of the manufacturing of the boats as well. What in your background has contributed to the expertise that allows you to manufacture the boats?
Not a lot, I'm afraid. I think my history goes back into the participation of the sport. I knew the first time I picked up a dragon boat paddle and paddled in my first race that there was something very unique and exciting, and the growth potential of the sport was huge. And as I said earlier, you know, it's a nice little niche for our company. It's all our eggs in one basket, but I think it's the only chicken in this case. Again, the boats, getting back to the boats, there's really no background other than just finding good people to provide the manufacturing process and importing the right products to build the boats to the high quality that they are.
So you import and then you manufacture with those different parts in Toronto?
Actually, we market and sell and lease two styles of boats, depending on if the event is an open water event, meaning there's potential for rough water, or if it's a flat water event, which is basically the canoe rowing courses that are available throughout the country. Now, our big open water boats are manufactured right here in Toronto, but many of the raw materials that are required come from other countries, like marine plywood comes from Brazil and some other materials from the U.S. The flat water boats are a fiberglass shell that's imported from Germany. It's a world championship boat by a company named BUK, and they're the largest manufacturer of dragon boats in the world, I believe. I think outside of the traditional boats built in Hong Kong. And so we bring these fiberglass boats in, we finish them here and distribute and lease them to our clients.
So what sector do you find has the greatest demand for your product and services?
Most of the events, I think, are, I believe all of them are, now that I think of it, are fundraisers. A charitable or nonprofit sector that constitutes the majority of our clients. And that's with respect to the events themselves. The other group of clients that we service are the actual corporate teams in and around the Greater Toronto area who require two or three practices a week throughout the entire summer as they prepare for all these festivals that go on in Ontario and across the country. So every evening at our Dragon Boat Club here in Toronto, there's literally dozens of teams that train. And these are corporate people who have just chosen this to be their sport, just as others may choose tennis, running. Many, many individuals have found that dragon boat racing is the sport for them.
So do you have any plans to go beyond the U.S. or the Canadian borders?
Well, the only untapped market beyond the United States and Canada, I believe, is South America. Dragon boat racing has not been introduced there yet, and I don't think that's a quantum leap for us. We just have to get the right people in place and put the logistics in place. Certainly expand beyond the North American market.
Are there any other services you intend to offer?
Primarily, we are involved in the event logistics, providing services to promote the growth and production of the sport. The manufacturing was basically evolved out of a need just to acquire quality equipment. It just wasn't available for us to purchase in the beginning, so we just said, well, we have to build our own. That has since evolved into a major part of our business. A lot of revenue comes from the sales of equipment. Many teams and clubs and cities, after a couple of years of hosting a festival, haven't enough revenue or they anticipate enough cash flow to purchase their own equipment and start clubs in their own towns. And that's happened in Sudbury, Guelph, Stratford, London, all these clients that have been around for a number of years.
You certainly have a broad range of customers. What events do you have coming up? Any in Winnipeg or across Canada that we could watch for?
I certainly know there is an event in Winnipeg. I'm not quite sure the date. I believe the end of July. They're not one of our clients. There's many festivals in Canada that use other equipment and services. There's other companies and boat owners that lease out equipment. But we certainly are the largest. We are producing 22 festivals this year in North America. Gone from just 2 to 3, maybe 5 years ago, to, as I said, almost a couple dozen. And from the ability to host maybe one event every couple of weeks to, I think there's a few weekends this year, we're doing 3 festivals in one weekend.
It's nice to hear that you're doing so well, and we want to thank you very much for coming on the program today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, thank you, and I hope to hear from you again.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was our guest for today, Mr. Mike Kirkman of Great White North Communications.
I'm your host, Susan Combe, and we thank you for listening to Business Rewind here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next time for another exploration of business history.